There is a renowned, decades-long Harvard University longitudinal study that is aimed at identifying the greatest source or sources of human happiness. For 88 years and ongoing, this study has meticulously tracked a diverse group of thousands of people through their life. And guess what the study has concluded to be the single greatest source of human happiness? Quality, long-term relationships. You see, as followers of Jesus, we can never fully experience the abundant life that Jesus wants for us until we get really good at building quality, long-term relationships, which ain't easy, because the problem with being in relationship with people is people. So, we are in the midst of an 8-week study in which we are looking at how we can build beautiful relationships the Jesus way, the way Jesus modeled for us. So far, we have identified 5 core principles for building beautiful relationships the Jesus way. Number one, develop a deep spiritual life, because that in turn gives us the direction, strength, and values we need to get better at relationships. It's when we draw close to God that we find within ourselves the wherewithal, the incentive, and the insights that we need to be in quality relationship and build those quality relationships with the people around us. Number two, be emotionally honest with the people around you. Secrets can kill us. Number three, say the hard things, but say them with love. Four, live to serve. Approach your relationships with a servant's heart, which is exactly what Jesus did, because our greatest meaning and purpose in life is found in serving the people around us. Number five, replace harsh judgmentalism of the people around you with compassionate evaluation. Now, today we come to the sixth core principle. Drum roll, please. The sixth principle is learn to forgive with great generosity, which may be the most challenging of all of these principles so far. So today, let's ask Jesus two key questions. Number one, why should I forgive? Number two, how can I get better at it? Shall we start with a prayer? Jesus, we are weak, but you are strong. So today we come to you in our weakness, grateful that you never give up on us, but keep patiently calling us, challenging us, coaxing us to live more beautiful lives. So today, move us closer to your ideal for us. We ask in your wonderful name, the name of Jesus. Amen. A pastor was preaching a sermon about the importance of forgiving. At one point in the sermon, the pastor asked the congregation by a show of hands, "Who here is willing to forgive your enemies?" Of course, in a situation like that, with all of that peer pressure, everybody's going to raise their hand, whether they mean it or not. So everybody raised their hand except one little old lady. sitting about halfway back. The pastor says, "Ms. Parker, you mean to tell me you're not willing to forgive your enemies?" She said, "I don't have any." The pastor said, "That's amazing. Miss Parker, if you don't mind, tell me, how old are you?" 96 years old. "That's remarkable, sisters, brothers, siblings," he says. "How is it possible?" "Miss Parker, I just have to invite you to step forward and share with us the secret of how someone who's 96 years old on this earth doesn't have an enemy in the world." So slowly, using her walker, she makes her way all the way to the front of the sanctuary. The pastor says, "Tell us, Ms. Parker, what is your secret to not having an enemy in the world when you've lived 96 long years?" She got a mischievous grin on her face and she said, "I've outlasted every single one of them." And there it is. The instinctive human way. What's the best way to get rid of your enemies? It is to outlast them. Show them no mercy. Give them no quarter. Nurse your anger. Hold your grudges. Separate and hate and hope that you never have to deal with them again. But then along comes Jesus challenging us to the very core of our being. Once Simon Peter asked Jesus, Matthew chapter 18, verse 21, "Lord, if my brother or sister sins against me, how often should I forgive them? As many as seven times?" Jesus replied, "Not seven times, but I tell you, 70 times seven." What? 490 different times? Even in the Sermon on the Mount, in teaching us the Lord's Prayer, Jesus taught us to pray these words: "Our Father who art in heaven, forgive us our debts as we have forgiven our debtors." Note the change in tense there. Forgive us our debts, present tense, right now, as we have, past tense, already forgiven our debtors. And just so we don't miss the point, after Jesus ends the prayer, he doubles back and reiterates this same point, saying, "For if you forgive others their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses." That's stark. That's bracing. Jesus is just laying it on the table for us. We heard these same themes echoed today in our gospel reading that Tony Ferguson shared with us so beautifully right before the sermon. There, Jesus said things like Luke 6:27, "Love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you, be merciful just as your Father is merciful. Don't judge and you won't be judged. Don't condemn and you won't be condemned." And now the words most relevant to our topic today: forgive and you will be forgiven. Give forgiveness and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put back into your lap. For the measure you give will be the measure you get back. I believe the most amazing story of forgiveness I have ever heard occurred in South Africa after the end of apartheid. I've shared this story with some of you before, but it's such a powerful and challenging story. It bears repeating from time to time. So in the aftermath of apartheid, the new South African government established what they called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was responsible for investigating and adjudicating crimes committed under apartheid. So picture a courtroom chocked full of observers, people. The galleys were full as a former apartheid police officer named Officer Vandenbroek is standing before the court and confessing the crimes that he had committed under apartheid. As Officer Vandenbroek is confessing his crimes, There's an elderly woman sitting in the front row paying intense attention, because Officer Vandenbroek is confessing crimes that profoundly affected her own family. Vandenbroek has tears streaming down his cheeks as he comes face to face and has to publicly acknowledge the heinous things that he did. He tells how years earlier he went to that woman's house when she was much younger, and he and some of his fellow officers kidnapped her then 18-year-old son, who was an anti-apartheid activist. They took her son to a deep woods, and there they shot him in the back of his head and then burned his body in a bonfire as they partied and drank around the bonfire. 5 years later, Officer Vandenbroek says, me and those officers returned to that same woman's house and this time kidnapped her husband, carried him off to those same woods. But before they executed him, Vandenbroek had a brilliant idea. An hour later, he shows up back at that woman's house, blindfolds her and compels her to go with him to the woods. Once in the woods, he unblindfolds her and forces her to watch as they douse her husband, bound hand and foot, in gasoline and lit him on fire. His last words to his wife were, "Forgive them." What? Forgive them. Now, many years later, Vandenbroek stands before this court and confesses his crimes, and then awaits his judgment. The presiding officer looks at the elderly woman sitting in the front row and asks her, "What do you want? What do you want us to do with him?" She rose, calmly leaning against her walker, and said, "I want three things. First," she said, "I want Officer Vandenbroek to take me back to the woods where he killed my son and my husband and burned their bodies so that I can gather up the dust and give them a proper burial. Second," she said, "Officer Vandenbroek took my whole family away from me. I still have lots of love to give. So I want Officer Vandenbroek to come to the ghetto twice a month to spend the afternoon with me so I can be like a mother to him, like the mother he apparently never had. And third," she said, "I want Officer Vandenbroek to know that God forgives him." And so do I. And so I want someone to help me across the room to where Officer Vandenbroek is so that I can embrace him and he can feel that my forgiveness is real." Someone helped her across the room. As she approached him, he fainted and fell to the ground, overcome. Someone in the galley began quietly singing "Amazing Grace." And before long, everybody joined in. That story challenges me to the very core of my being. And I find myself asking myself, could I? Could I forgive somebody under similar circumstances? Would I? And why? Jesus, why should I? Why should anybody? Why should we forgive those who do heinous things, who wound us, who hurt us in deep ways? This morning, let me suggest two possible answers to that question. Why, Jesus? Why should we forgive? The first of those being, forgiveness is of enormous benefit to my own body, mind, and spirit. I think typically we tend to think that forgiving others is mostly about them and what our forgiveness gives to them. I think that's exactly backwards, that our forgiving of others, it's not primarily for the one I'm forgiving, but for me and how it benefits me holistically, body, mind, and spirit. A third grade teacher one day gives her third graders an assignment. She says, go home tonight and I want you to bring back to you with school to school tomorrow, bring back with you a sack of potatoes. Each of you bring a sack of potatoes and a clear plastic trash bag. So the next day the students return with their potatoes, their trash bags. The teacher says, okay, I want you now to take your potatoes and on each potato, I want you to write the name of someone who's done you wrong. So the students start to really get into this. On each potato, they write a different name of somebody who's done them wrong. They start telling each other the stories about people who've done them wrong. Okay, now the teacher said, I want you to put your potatoes in your clear plastic trash bag and tie it off at the top. And your assignment for the next few weeks is to carry that trash bag with you everywhere you go. At first, the kids are thinking, this is kind of fun. This is kind of novel. So they lug their trash bags full of potatoes with them to the cafeteria that day and out to the playground at recess and take them home with them on the bus at night and put them next to their bed as they sleep at night. But by the next morning, as they're lugging that heavy bag of potatoes back to school, it's not so fun anymore. It's starting to get tiring and wearing. It's heavy. It's obnoxious. Eventually, several weeks into this experiment, the potatoes start to sprout eyes and to get moldy and to get slimy so that what's in the bag is now a disgusting looking mix. When finally the teacher says, okay, you can throw your trash bags away now, but I want you to never forget the moral of the story, which is when we hold grudges, when we carry bitterness inside of us, it's like that sack of potatoes. It's heavy. It weighs on us. And it starts to rot inside of us. Ron McManus once put it this way. Bitterness is like drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die. When a poisonous snake bites you, it's not the snake bite that kills you. It's the poison that gets released into your system, which, if not treated with an antidote soon enough, will kill you. In that analogy, the snake bite is the offense that someone commits against us. The venom is the bitterness that gets released within our bodies. If we don't treat that venom with the antibody of forgiveness soon enough, that bitterness can literally kill us. Did you know that numerous medical studies have documented that forgiveness, it doesn't just affect our spirit, it affects our entire body. Numerous studies have been done that create two control groups, a control group of people who seem to be able to forgive well and a control group of people who struggle to forgive, and then tracking them and gathering statistics over time. These studies have demonstrated that people who get good at forgiving significantly reduce their risk of high blood pressure, heart attacks, tension, headaches, and chronic back pain, anxiety, depression. People who get good at forgiving, it strengthens their immune system. It gives them higher self-esteem. And a Johns Hopkins study meticulously documented that people that get good at forgiving, It relieves their stress. The Johns Hopkins study demonstrated that people who carry grudges and bitterness inside of them, it puts their body in a constant low-level state of fight or flight, which wears terribly on the body, creating higher risk of these different symptoms. Jesus doesn't tell us to forgive people just to make our lives more difficult. He tells us to forgive because he knows the benefits of forgiving will come back to us on every wave. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over. Good things will be put back into our lap when we forgive. Louis Zamparelli was a U.S. World War II soldier who became a bomber pilot. On May the 27th, 1943, Louis and his co-pilot were sent on a reconnaissance mission. Another bomber had gone down in the South Pacific with its crew. So now Louis and his co-pilot were on a reconnaissance mission to see if he could locate the wreckage and if there were any survivors. 800 miles away from home base, Louis and his co-pilot, their own plane starts to experience mechanical problems, and their plane ends up going down in the South Pacific. For the next 47 days, a world's record, by the way, they survived at sea on a makeshift life raft, 47 days of fending off shark attacks, starvation, hallucination, when on the 47th day, the Japanese found them and took them to the infamous Sugamo prison camp. For the next 2 years, until the war ended, Louis and his co-pilot were stuck there being targeted and tormented intentionally, tortured, physically tortured, verbally abused, especially by one particular guard who went by the nickname the Birdman. When the war ended, Louis, the co-pilot, the other prisoners were released. He came back to the United States a hero. He had been given up for dead. Nobody knew he was still alive. He returns to the United States a hero, but a broken person from all of the trauma that he had experienced. He began to struggle mightily with excessive alcohol use and with anxiety. And he had this recurring nightmare. Again and again, he dreamed that he was murdering the bird, the man who had tortured him. Several years later, Louis, still tormented, goes to a Billy Graham crusade. And at the altar call, he responds. He decides he wants to become a follower of Jesus. But you know what that means, right? Followers of Jesus are required to forgive. So Louis begins the difficult process of trying to forgive the Birdman. As part of that process, there came a point where Louis, with a group of other World War II U.S. soldiers who were in that same prison camp, traveled back to that prison camp for a face-to-face meeting with their former captors, not unlike what happened with some U.S. soldiers after the Vietnam War in some of these reconciliation meetings. So Louis goes back to the prison camp, is face-to-face with those captors, and at one point he asks, "Who here is the bird?" Years had passed. "Who's the bird? Is the bird man here?" The Japanese told him, "He's not here." 2 years after the war, he killed himself. Imagine what Louis Zamparini must have felt in that moment when he learned that his oppressor had killed himself. Actually, we don't have to imagine, because Louis shared his story with Laura Hildebrand. And she tells the story in her book, Unbroken. She describes, as Louis described to her, what he felt in that moment when he heard that his enemy had taken his own life. Quote, "Louis felt something he'd never felt for the bird before. With a shiver of amazement, he realized what he was feeling was compassion. At that moment, something shifted sweetly inside Louis. It was forgiveness, beautiful and finally effortless and complete. For Louis Zamperini, the war was finally over. He was finally able to put down and throw away that heavy bag of rotten potatoes, that bag of bitterness. That's why Jesus is so adamant that we learn to get good at forgiving the people who hurt us, the people who oppress us. Why is it so important, Jesus? Because the act of forgiveness is of enormous benefit to my own body, mind, and spirit. It's not so much about the person who hurt me as about me and the benefits that accrue to me when I am able to forgive and let that go. But there is also a second really important reason why Jesus is so adamant that we forgive. Not just because of the benefits to our body, mind, and spirit, but also because forgiving is the only way I'll ever be able to experience the blessing of quality, long-term relationships. It is impossible for any of us to be in a long-term relationship with anybody else without them hurting us, disappointing us, at times wounding us, and vice versa. People are people. We're all broken and we all break things. So the only way any of us are ever going to be able to experience the beauty of quality long-term relationships is if we get really good at forgiving. I'm sure everybody here heard this past week that Dolly Parton passed away. Many of you also know that every year at Thanksgiving time, my spouse David and I take a week where we travel to the Smoky Mountains, rent a cabin near Gatlinburg, and each year on our trip, we take a pilgrimage to a holy site there known as Dollywood. By the way, if you've never been to Dollywood, it's a really great theme park. And we're really grateful to Dolly for creating that place because it's given us many beautiful memories. But back in 2009, when Dolly Parton was being interviewed on the Joy Behar show, now remember 2009 was what, 4 years before the Supreme Court reached its marriage equality decision. So in 2009, it was still a hot and heavy debate about gay marriage. So Joy Behar asked Dolly Parton, "Are you in favor of gay marriage?" Dolly responded by saying, "Why not? I think gay people should have to suffer as much as all the rest of us." Marriage is wonderful, but it's never easy. I've been married for 35 years. It's wonderful, but it's never easy when two people are merging their lives together and sharing everything so closely in life together. It is inevitable that they're going to hurt you or disappoint you or wound you, and vice versa. No quality long-term marriage can survive unless those two people get really good at forgiving. In 3 decades of pastoral counseling, I have been stunned at how many people who are in beautiful long-term marriages, when I sit down and talk to them in a private conversation, I have been stunned at how often they will tell me about one or more instances along the way in their marriage where something so serious and wounding happened. It would have been easy for that marriage to completely fall apart, but they decided that forgiving each other was worth it. And now years later, they're still in that beautiful relationship. I'm not saying that that always works out that way. I am saying, however, that you will rarely see a long-term beautiful relationship that has not had points in it where extraordinary acts of forgiveness had to be offered. And what is true of marriage is true of all of our important people relationships. Paula Hewsley was pregnant with her 3rd child. She had 2 young boys, Jeremy and Brian, and now she was carrying her 3rd son, soon to be born. Paula's best friend, Mary, asked Paula's 4-year-old son, Jeremy, "Are you excited about getting a new brother?" Jeremy thought for a second and then said, "No," he says, "I guess we may as well just keep Brian," his younger brother. Have you ever found yourself wishing you could trade in one of your siblings for a new model? Have your siblings ever found themselves wishing they could trade you in for a new model? Whether we're talking about at home or in extended family or at work or at church or in our neighborhood or in our friendship circles, it is impossible to have quality long-term relationships without us getting really good at forgiving. There's an old movie, a 1999 movie called The Straight Story, that tells a story about 2 elderly brothers who had been close, lifelong friends, but then in their elder years, they got into some kind of a big dispute and had been estranged for 10 years. Alvin Straight lived in Iowa. His brother Lyle lived in Wisconsin, by the way. This is a true story. When Alvin threw the grapevine, having not talked to his brother for 10 years, through the grapevine, Alvin hears that his brother Lyle has suffered a massive stroke that could be life-threatening. All of a sudden, it hits him that he might lose his brother without ever being able to reconcile with him, and so Alvin desperately tries to figure out how they can reconcile. He tries calling Lyle over and over again, but Lyle won't take his calls. So Alvin decides the only thing he can do is drive all the way to Wisconsin. The only problem is his eyesight is so poor he had lost his driver's license. So he decides he's going to drive 500 miles from Iowa to his brother's house in Wisconsin on his lawn tractor. Remember, this is a true story. Midway on that weeks-long journey, one night, Alvin is camping out a campfire in a small church cemetery next door to a church, and next to that, the pastor in the parsonage notices the campfire in the cemetery, goes out to investigate. That leads to a long conversation, Alvin explaining to the pastor the journey that he's on, what he's doing, why he's there. And as Alvin is sharing this with the pastor, he begins to reminisce about the good old days between him and his brother. He tells the pastor, "Lyle and I grew up as close as brothers could be. We were raised in Moorhead, Minnesota. We worked hard. Me and Lyle would make games out of our chores. He and I used to sleep out in the yard most every summer's night. We'd talk to each other till we went to sleep. somehow it made our trials seem smaller. We pretty much talked each other through growing up. The pastor asks, whatever happened between the two of you? Alvin begins to tear up. He says, the story is as old as Cain and Abel. Anger, vanity. Mix that together with liquor, and you've got two brothers who haven't spoken in 10 years. Alvin pauses. Then he says, whatever it was that made me and Lyle so mad, it doesn't matter anymore. I want to make peace. Sit with him and look up at the stars like we used to do. Several days later, Alvin finally arrives at Lyle's house, turns up the long driveway, gets off his lawn tractor, walks up to the house and calls out, Lyle! Lyle! Are you in there? No response. Alvin starts to worry that maybe Lyle has passed away already. But then, the door cracks and slowly opens, revealing an old man leaning on a walker. Lyle looks and says, Alvin, is that you? Yep. Lyle says, you mean to tell me you rode that thing all the way here just to see me? Yep. And suddenly, the ice melts. All that has come between them, it doesn't matter anymore. And before long, they're embracing on the front porch. And they sit down on the front porch and they start to talk and to catch up and to reminisce. And before long, the sun sets and it's nighttime and the stars are out and they're still on the front porch talking. Just like old times, life is good again. They were brothers again. Jesus wants that for us. Beautiful lifetime relationships. Don't waste years estranged from people around you. Do you want to be happy? Do you want to live beautiful lives? Or do you just want to get even, stand your ground, protect your turf? It ain't worth it. Forgive for Christ's sake as God has forgiven you. So, why do we forgive? Because of the enormous benefit it gives to me, my own body, my own mind, my own spirit, and because, too, it's the only way I'll ever be able to experience the blessing of quality long-term relationships, which is life's chief joy. If we were to try to sum this up in a single statement, it might go like this. The more you forgive, the more you can live. But that still leaves another important question. How? Jesus, if I'm supposed to forgive, even when it's really hard, how can I get better at that? Unfortunately, we're out of time. So you go home and figure it out yourself. No. Give me 5 minutes because I want to share with you quickly a checklist of 5 practical steps that we can take that can help us to get better at doing the really hard thing that Jesus tells us to do, to forgive those who sin against us. Practical step number 1, remember that forgiving starts with a decision. Forgiving is a decision, it's not a feeling. If I wait till I feel like starting to forgive, I'll never get there. Jesus instructs us to forgive. We are followers of Jesus. It's not optional. It's a requirement for followers of Jesus. So whether I feel like it or not, I simply have to make a decision to start to forgive. But I intentionally use that phrase, start to forgive, because point number two is that forgiving is a process. Forgiving someone is a process that requires persistent practice, maybe even Jesus suggests 490 times. Because you know how it is. On day one, you decide to forgive somebody, and by the time evening comes, you're mad at them again. You just find that anger still stirring inside of you. So you have to decide again to forgive them. But then the next morning you wake up and that bitterness is coming back. And so you have to decide again to forgive them. And again and again. 2 steps forward, 1 step backward. That's typical. That's normal. That's part of the process. When Jesus says, if your brother or sister sins against you, forgive them as many as 490 times. Maybe he meant forgive them for 490 different offenses. But he also may have meant that sometimes somebody hurts us so bad that forgiving them for that one thing is going to require 490 different decisions to forgive them before that forgiveness finally becomes so real that we can finally feel it inside of us. So be persistent. Keep practicing the process of forgiving. Step number three. Each time you feel that anger rising within you toward the offender, stop, interrupt that thought, and say a short prayer of blessing for that person. This is a specific thing that Jesus himself tells us to do. You heard it in today's scripture passage. He repeats it in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5:44. I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you. So each time you find yourself feeling that bitterness toward that person, catch yourself, interrupt that, and pray, God, I pray for so-and-so that you will bless them today, that something really good will happen for them today. Because when you pray for somebody that way, it can't help but start to shift what you're feeling inside of yourself toward them. But notice Jesus doesn't just say pray for them. He says do good things that bless them. So that's step number four. Think of some good things you can do to intentionally bless the person that you're trying to forgive. You might do it anonymously. You might do it directly, whatever feels appropriate. So ask yourself, is there something, if you're really upset with your spouse and you're trying to forgive, ask yourself, okay, what's something good I can do today that will bless them? It might be a very small thing, but that act of blessing them also shifts over time how we're feeling about that person inside of ourselves. Finally, step number five. Remember, when you forgive someone, you're banking enormous grace that's going to come back to you on many waves. That's the last thing Jesus said to us in our gospel lesson. Forgive and you will be forgiven, for the measure you give will be the measure you get back. So when I'm struggling to forgive somebody, I picture myself when I forgive them, it's as if I'm accruing grace in an account that I get to draw on when I need God and others to forgive me. And believe you me, I need God and others to forgive me often. And so I think to myself, okay, forgiving this person is building up my own bank of grace that I am going to need to draw on. So let's say, hypothetically, your spouse always puts his dirty dishes in the sink for you to rinse and clean. And you're thinking, why does he always have to do this? And then it hits me. Ah, this is an opportunity for me to show grace and grow my own bank of grace. This is a chance for me to show the kind of mercy that I want God and others to show me. So when you leave your dirty dishes in the sink, just think to yourself, I'm giving my spouse an opportunity to have the blessing of showing me grace so that they can build up grace in their account, right? See how this works? Five key suggestions for how we can get better at forgiving. I'll close with this. I told you earlier about the greatest act of forgiveness I've ever heard of outside of the Bible. Let me close by telling you the greatest act of forgiveness I've ever personally witnessed. It's when I was about 9 years old, and we at the time, my mom, dad, my two sisters, we lived far out in the countryside. It was then the countryside, near Acton, Indiana, down towards Shelbyville, wide open spaces, farms and woods and so forth. So we lived in a small house on a large acreage lot. And then our neighbors to the south lived on a small or a large acreage lot. And in between our two lots was a smaller, narrower, vacant lot that eventually the owner of that lot decided to sell it. A family living in Indianapolis, the Nelsons, decided to buy that lot to build their dream house on it. You know, these were city folk who were thinking, oh, it would be wonderful to raise our kids out in the countryside. So they buy this lot, intending to build this big house on it, only to discover that the house they want to build on it is too big for the lot and would require a zoning variance because they'd have to build it so close to the property lines. So they apply for a zoning variance. Let's just say that my family and our neighbors to the south were not very happy about it. These city slickers moving out to the countryside and jamming this big house in between our house, destroying the sense of space that we had created our homes to enjoy. Now they're coming out and doing this. And to make matters worse, the zoning board gave them their zoning variances. We were convinced they had bribed the zoning board. So they were able to build this big old house within 5 feet of our neighbor's property line, and they were able to put their big fancy blacktop driveway — country folk back then didn't have blacktop driveways — their big fancy blacktop driveway smack dab on the edge of our property line. Before they built the house, Ed Nelson decided that rather than paying somebody to cut down the old growth trees to create a place for them to build their house, he was going to rent a chainsaw and do it for himself. After all, how hard can it be to cut down a tree, right? He'd never cut down a tree before in his life. He's going to cut down these old growth trees. He proceeds to cut down an 80-foot old growth tree that ends up toppling right on top of our neighbor's roof, exploding it like a bomb went off, one of the big limbs narrowly missing, spearing their son, who was still asleep in bed. Let's just say that by the time the Nelsons moved into their fancy new house, they were not welcome in our neighborhood. The tension was thick. My dad happened to notice that when Ed backed his big Oldsmobile out of his garage, he would have to back up to turn around and get out all the way, his back tire all the way to the edge of the blacktop driveway, which means the big back end of his Oldsmobile was sticking over our property line. So Dad went out and drove three metal stakes where Ed needed to back out, right on the property line, so that now when Ed tried to get out of his garage, he'd have to back up, pull forward, and wedge himself out of his garage. That showed him, you reap what you sow. Me and my sisters would watch this out of our window and laugh. The tension was so thick you could cut the air. When we were in the backyard and they were in their backyard, it was like it was a war zone. We pretended they weren't there. They pretended we weren't there. One night, our family was out around a campfire having a weenie roast, marshmallows, s'mores, hot dogs, things like that, when Ed Nelson happened to be working out in his backyard about 30 feet away from us. All of a sudden, out of the blue, my dad called out, "Hey, neighbor." I thought, oh no, what's going to happen? This is going to be terrible. "Hey, neighbor," Dad said, "why don't you come over and have a beer?" As a 9-year-old, I was dumbfounded. What? I thought that was supposed to be our enemy. What are you doing inviting? Ed stood there like, did I hear what he said? So dad repeated himself, get your wife and your two daughters and come on over. So Ed goes inside. 5 minutes later, he comes out with Pam, his wife, and their two kids, Lana and Sherry. And before long, we're all sitting around the campfire having hot dogs, s'mores, dad and Ed sharing a sacred beer. And we start to share stories and learn about them and them about us. And within a couple hours, they're our new best friends, wonderful neighbors. And for the years that followed, wonderful neighbors. The war was over. We had our neighborhood back. Things were good again. Our family was better. The Nelsons were better. The neighborhood was better. The world was a little bit better. To put it in a simple phrase, the more you forgive, the more you can live. In your life today, who do you need to forgive? It's a choice you can make. What choice will you make? Amen.